Blog Talk Radio.
And now broadcasting live from Washington, D.C. and the shores of the Great Salt Lake in Utah, it's the Hallie Cancer Jane Show with Mojo. Today's Hallie Cancer Jane Show with Mojo is being brought to you by HCJ Studios. HCJ Studios is a boutique publishing company and media house specializing in product conception focused on exceptional product and design. And welcome to the Hallie Cancer Jane Show with Mojo. This is Mojo. We're sitting here on the edge, the shoreline of the Great Salt Lake in Salt Lake, Utah. And out on the East Coast is our impeccable, sassy, and smart co-host, Miss Hallie Cancer Jane.
I am here, Joe. Hi, Joe.
Hi, Hallie. How are you doing today?
Oh, I'm just peachy keen. Actually, I'm apple keen. It's apple weather here in the Blue Ridge Mountains. It is absolutely an exquisite day. You know, we really haven't had any cold weather, and today, sunny blue skies, red wine-colored trees and golden trees and golden apples and red apples. You can just smell apple cider in the air time here in Washington, D.C. That's the fact. Joe, I haven't spoken to you all week. You've been so busy. You've been on crazy shifts this week. How are you feeling, John?
I'm making it. Thank you for asking. I am coming back to the daylight. I've been in the dark for the last 8 weeks.
No more vampire time, huh?
Well, for a while. We'll have to see what happens.
That's very, very good. I'm happy to hear that because I was missing having my little weekly chats with you. And now I'm going to be able to bug you more often during the day. I can't wait.
Oh, boy. Thanks. Anyway.
Yes, dear.
Hey, once again, welcome to the Hallie Cancer Jane Show with Mojo. And we are live on the radio. It's a little bit after 5 p.m. on the East Coast, 2 p.m. Pacific. And I tell you what, our guest today, Hallie, is just an awesome lady. And, you know, as a novice meteorologist, that's what I call myself, she went on a little trip, and I'm sure that we're going to discuss that with her here a little bit. A very long trip, probably over a couple months of storm chasing. So, you know, without further ado, Hallie, won't you just go ahead and introduce our special guest for today?
Okay, I will, Joe. Thank you so much. Good listen to you. She is an author. She is Jenna Blum. And Jenna has written what I believe, personally, is one of the great novels of our time, Those Who Save Us. And she has now followed that up with another raging tale, The Storm Chasers. Let me tell you a little bit about Jenna Blum. Oprah Winfrey listed Jenna on her choice of the top 30 women writers, which includes notable authors like Toni Morrison, Maya Angelou, Margaret Atwood, Alice Siebel, just to name a few. Jenna Blum's matchless ability to tell a story is equal only to her brilliant insight into the spectrum of human emotion. At the heart of her works is always the raging storm of humanity. We're going storm chasing through Jenna Blum's life. Welcome to the Hallie Cancer Jane Show with Mojo, Jenna Blum. So, Jenna, are you there?
Hi, I am. I'm trying to figure out how to live up to my own advanced press. That was very impressive. Thank you.
Wow. God, my dogs are barking. They got so excited about listening to you. I'm going to start with one quick question, and I promise you, you're going to love this. Tell me, are you a raging storm?
I was kind of smiling to myself about that. My mom actually always says that I'm her sunny baby and that my sister is the stormy one. So I don't really know how I got this reputation for being the raging storm of human nature, but I think, you know, in demeanor, I tend to be pretty sunny, which is confusing for a lot of my readers because my books have the raging storm of human nature in them. I mean, they tend to be pretty dark books that explore pretty difficult subjects. So maybe I'm sort of two-sided that way.
Maybe. Let's start from the beginning. Let's go back to your childhood. I think it's always interesting to ask an author a little bit about their beginnings to see where they're coming from. Tell us a little bit.
Sure. Sure. I grew up in Montclair, New Jersey, which is like Soprano land. In fact, when that series came out on HBO, it explained a lot to me about why I wasn't allowed to mouth off to certain adults in my neighborhood. And my dad was a news writer who commuted into New York to write for the network. So he wrote for CBS and NBC and ABC and Walter Cronkite and Harry Reasoner and Dan Rather. And my earliest memories are punctuated by the sound of my dad's typewriter. I'm going to assume that everybody in the audience knows what a typewriter is. It's not just like an app. Yeah. When I speak at colleges, they're sometimes like, what app is that? I'm like, no, it's an old-fangled machine. But I always wanted to be a writer like my dad, and I never really wanted to be anything else, which is lucky because I'm not good at anything else except writing, talking about writing, and teaching writing, and then food service, which I did for a really long time to supplement my writing career.
You were 16 when you started writing professionally, right?
I started writing actually when I was 4, and I had really grandiose ambitions from that age. Also, I started out with stories about, you know, mermaids and princesses and a brief sadistic period in which I wanted to be a barber, so I wrote stories about haircuts. And it wasn't until the ripe old age of 16 that I had my first short story published. My mom submitted it on my behalf to 17 magazine, and the story won the National Fiction Prize that year, and it was called The Legacy of Frank Finkelstein, and it was about the dangers of cliques. I was a very John Hughes kind of teenager and fancied myself perpetually on the outside, and so I wrote this satire about cliques. And after that, I thought the world owed me a living as a writer, and again, I found out the world owed me a living in food service for a couple more decades until my books were published.
First of all, let me tell you something. Do you know that I'm a Jersey girl, too?
No, I didn't know that. Well, don't even get me started with
I grew up
the accent, girlfriend.
There
oh my
you go,
God,
right? That
Rangers,
must have been the
right?
thing. I'll tell you how I met Jenna. I read her book, Those Who Save Us, and I wrote my first fan letter ever in my life to Jenna. And we met
I'm
on
so
Facebook.
I'm so honored by that. Thank
no,
you. I appreciate
you know,
that.
True. You know, I read everything. You know, I've been in the biz for so long, blah, 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 and I've never done that. And that book just so chilled me. I had to do that. So let's talk about
Thank
Those
you.
Who Save Us, which is your blockbuster. My gosh, girl, that book has sold a zillion copies. It's still on bestseller list in Europe, if I'm not correct, right? And
it is.
Tell us,
yeah.
It's phenomenal. And so tell us, Thank just give us like a little bit of the, you know, the background, what the story is about.
Sure, I will. I just want to back up a little bit, though, and thank you for sending in the fan mail. A lot of readers who write to me say, I've never done this before, and do you even read your own email, let alone respond to it? And I had such a response of gratitude to any reader who's going to take the time to read one of my books and then, you know, take more time to write me his or her thoughts about it. That is really like a miracle to a writer who wrote both books in total isolation, praying that somebody someday somewhere would read them. So don't ever be afraid to write to a writer. We love it. And even if we're too shy to write back, which I never am, you know, we still love it. Anyway, Those Who Save Us is my first novel, my debut novel, and it is about a German woman during World War II who becomes the mistress of an SS officer to protect herself and her little daughter when she's discovered in the act of the resistance. And then the daughter's quest 50 years later to find out what the mother did, because the mother refuses in her very Teutonic way to talk about it. And that book was the book that Publishers Weekly called the little book that could, because when it came out as a debut, like many first novels, I called the hardcover edition the family and friends edition, because that was pretty much who bought it. Like, nobody really knows when a debut novelist puts out a book. But then it had the great good fortune of being picked up by book clubs across the country and passed around from book club to book club. And 2 years after the paperback came out, it jumped onto the New York Times list. So it has really been just this miraculous journey for me of, you know, this lifelong panting desire to be a writer, suddenly having the book get published like 33 years into my life and then having it finally jump onto the list.
That's an incredible story. You know,
phenomenal.
I didn't know that part of the story, that it happened
yeah.
like that. It's not autobiographical. That's one thing I want to clear up. A lot of people think that it is. It's not, right?
Definitely not. I mean, when I show up at readings and I'm not an 80-year-old German woman or a 50-something German professor with an attitude problem, people are surprised. They're like, who is this smiling blonde chick? You know, but The novel is inspired by my family background, my mom being part German and part Norwegian, and my dad being Jewish. And so I grew up with this inherited interest in the time period of the Holocaust, and my mom took me to Germany when I was right out of college and really gave me the key to the book.
You worked on Steven Spielberg's Shower Project. Did that have anything to do with how the story germinated?
The Spielberg Project, which enabled me to interview Holocaust survivors and preserve their testimonies on camera for the foundation, was an enormous privilege. And in fact, I had already written a draft of the book when I began working as an interviewer. I had been to Germany with my mom and had become fascinated with the question of what would she have done if she had been a German woman during World War II. In fact, my mom grew up in rural Minnesota, in the town that I'm talking to you from now. And so that's not autobiographical at all. But when I was in that country, this question exercised a great hold on me. And so I wrote the first draft of Those Who Save Us, which was soundly rejected by many, many agents and only served to point out to me how much research I needed to do into the time period. And I got involved with the Shoah Foundation as sort of a side effect of doing my research. I never intended it to be research for the book because it was too important in its own right and it's such an enormous privilege. But doing the interviewing, while I didn't use any of the interviews in the novel because they don't belong to me, helped imbue the book with its emotional spectrum. Survivors often felt terrible guilt and shame and dread that permeated their daily lives, and they also had great pride at having survived and the hope that enabled them to build dynastic families. So it was really an incredible emotional thing to be involved with while I was revising that first draft of Those Who Save Us.
If you've never been to the Holocaust Museum in Washington, D.C., any of the listeners out there, I highly recommend you go when they do play Steven's film. And it is not a depressing experience. It is the most engaging and uplifting in the most bizarre way. I'm sure you've been there, Jenna.
it's
extraordinary.
It's an amazing
thing. I'm going to read
that.
Go ahead, sweetie.
Oh, no, go ahead. I was just going to say that at the end of every interview that we did for the Shoah Foundation, the interviewers would then allow family members to be on camera with the survivors. And it always ended the interview on this note that of this great hope and pride where, you know, the interviewer would be crying, that would be me, the videographer would be crying, the videographer's assistant would be crying, all the family members would be crying, and then the survivors would just be sitting there in the middle smiling because they had gone through this terrible conflagration and walked through the fire and come out the other side. So I imagine that, you know, that's part of the experience for many people visiting the Holocaust Museum.
It's extraordinary. Here's what the San Francisco Chronicle said about your book. The book's power lies in examining the emotional and moral gray area between heroism and collaboration. I think this book, I always try and figure out what it is that this book did to me, because I know, and in discussions with other people. And it looks at something that's never been looked at before. And we're going to discuss that in a minute, and that is from a person who's not isn't Jewish in what happens to them. You know, that the Nazi Holocaust was more than just to the Jews, and I think that was such an important aspect of it. You placed a great deal of the book, of course, in Nazi Germany, and it was a character in itself. Just the word Nazi conjures all sorts of images, you know, and, you know, Omer Sturmfuhrer and Nazi and Buchenwald. How, living with that, my God, how long did it take you to write this book?
It took me 3 years to write the book, really, from start to finish, but it took me 10 years to research it on and off. And, I mean, it wasn't as though I was glued to my chair reading about Buchenwald every day, but when I was actually writing the book, that was pretty much all I did. I was teaching at Boston University then, and also a class for Grub Street writers in Boston where I still teach. It's an independent writing school. And the only time I really left my apartment was to get more coffee, to go teach my classes, and then I would come back to the apartment and just buckle down and read books about Nazi Germany, from Rise and Fall of Third Reich to Who's Who in Nazi Germany and the Buchenwald Report, and I would watch movies about Nazi Germany. I took German classes at which I was an utter failure, and I baked everything that appears in the novel also.
Really
no small thing, because half the book is set in a bakery, and so I did a lot of baking. I was always pretty flowery at that point in my life. Flowery and grim at the same time.
Well, I want to know, are you still baking, and is it good, and can I come visit?
Anytime, actually. Tomorrow I'm going to spend my whole day baking. I heard you mention the apples before. In southeast Minnesota, it's apple season here, too, and pears, and so, yeah. Tomorrow's baking day, so come on over. I'm coming over.
So were you depressed during the writing of this book, or were you finding it cathartic? What was the emotional experience for you? I mean, I'm a writer. I know what it takes out of you to write, but some things are more intense than others.
It's a great question. I actually, the way I felt when I was writing this book a lot of the time reminded me of the Graham Greene quote, "There's a splinter of ice in the heart of every writer." Because for me, the actual act of sitting down to write every day was like opening up a window and looking through it and seeing what my characters were doing. And I plot out my books extremely carefully. So before I sat down to actually write up the scenes, which translate to the chapters in the book, I would be writing to myself longhand in these canvas-covered notebooks and trying to suss out what was the point of that day's scene and how is it going to do in the book and what would it express about the characters and their awful, awful predicaments. And so it was partly an architectural exercise that I was trying very hard to carry off. And emotionally, it was a catharsis for me because I had been carrying these scenes around in my head ever since I was a little girl and read The Diary of Anne Frank and When Hitler Stole Pink Rabbit and played the game in my head that many Jewish and half-Jewish children do of, you know, who would save me if the Nazis came and where would I go and who would hide me? I mean, in my house in New Jersey in the 70s, I had hiding places in case the Nazis came marching up our driveway. And so a lot of the dread and the terror that I imagined my Jewish counterparts in the 40s must have felt, I channeled into the novel. And I had literally been thinking about that for like 30 years. So it was really great to be able to put that down in cold, clear scenes. And after the book was done, I listened to it on audio once during a three-day drive, and then it was an extremely emotional experience, and even though I knew what had happened to all the characters because I made up their stories, I was still crying in my car and saying, oh my God, these poor people. So I know it packs a wallop on the reading side.
So I assume, therefore, it's fair to say that The Diary of Anne Frank had quite an impact on you, darling. As
yeah,
it did most
The Diary
of
Anne Frank did, for sure it did, yeah. Mm-hmm. And then I had the flip side of the coin, too, thinking, you know, if I had been in Nazi Germany as a native-born German or considered an Aryan, I'm kind of making finger quotes here, as my mom would have been because she's German and Norwegian, then what would I have done in that situation? So I carried all of these emotional coin-flipping scenarios around in my head for so many years that it was finally a relief to be able to set them down on paper.
Unbelievable. Those Who Save Us deals with secrets and guilt and shame, and I got to ask you, you write so intensely about them, and you're so right on about your portrayal of those emotions. I mean, were there secrets and shame as a part of your life? I mean, you really do play it better than anybody I've ever read.
Well, gosh, thank you. I'm really humbled by that.
You're quite welcome.
Thank you very much. Thanks. I mean, if I did have secrets, I couldn't tell you because they wouldn't be secrets anymore. But I don't really have a life that's haunted by terrible secrets the way my characters do. I'm interested in the concept of guilt and shame and what it makes people do and people acting from fear, which I think is just such a universal thing that a lot of times people make their worst decisions because they're acting from fear and they're scared of something. I think the guilt for me is probably also an inherited guilt because my dad was Jewish and my mom was Lutheran. And even though neither of them were practicing, they used to have these arguments about whose guilt was more powerful, the Lutheran guilt or the Jewish guilt, like, oi, you know, or, oh, yeah, you betcha then, mine is more powerful. So I really never had a chance, just had a guilty little soul. But in terms of the baggage that my characters carry around, both in Those Who Save Us and The Storm Chasers, I really have nothing like that in my own life, and I'm grateful for that. I think the security that I felt as somebody who's, you know, encouraged to be a writer her whole life and has come from a pretty safe place historically and demographically probably enables me to take leaps of imaginative faith into the lives of people whose circumstances are a lot worse.
There's an old saying about secrets, that you're only as sick as your deepest, darkest secrets. And certainly the mother in Those Who Save Us was a conflicted, painful woman to read about. Was that your point?
My point in Those Who Save Us really was there, but for the grace of God go I theme, that when I wrote the book, I was thinking of a sort of judge not lest you be judged scenario, because I think if you take somebody who's historically as unpopular as a German woman who's then an SS officer's mistress, you would think, oh my gosh, what a totally morally bankrupt character. And what I wanted to do was write her from the inside out so that you could see how somebody who was essentially an ordinary woman caught in the wrong place at the wrong time could make what Holocaust scholars then now call the choiceless choice. And so I wanted to explore that sort of prism of choices that Anna, the mother in the novel, has a chance to make through the eyes of just one person, and the characters around her have their own choices to make also, and some of them act in ways we would consider heroic and some villainous, but most in between. So I really just wanted to hold a situation up to the light and say, you know what, it's not a black and white situation. There really are a lot of shades of gray here, because that's what human behavior is comprised of. I guess to return to the theme of secrecy, I would imagine, and you can agree or disagree with me about this, I'd be interested to know, but I think a lot of writers are sort of secretive by nature, because we like to play our cards close to our chest in terms of what we're working on, and we get a lot of our material from other people, and if you told those people that you were poaching from them, they might not be too happy about that. I mean, when I was a little kid, I had a Harriet the Spy notebook, and, you know, that wasn't always such a great thing in my family, because I was always writing about the neighbors. But I think that being a writer teaches you a certain amount about secrecy that you can then extrapolate into your characters.
Yeah, I kind of agree with that. I think one thing that writers do is they catalog people. They look at people. I mean, I always notice when I'm with writers, whether I'm doing a book signing or whatever it is, when there are other writers in the room or something, that what they do is they're looking very intently at people, and you can see them really, really trying to understand them, who's speaking psychologically, and they're cataloging it in their own mind. That's number one. And I think the other thing is, I think you're right. I think that what writers wind up doing is writing their own inners through their characters, because even though you're an outgoing kind of person, surely I'm an outgoing kind of person, but there's also the other side that's very strong, and because it's the yin and the yang, which we're going to discuss later, you know, a little bit about the lifestyle of a writer, you know, out, in. Another thing this book, I think, so well does portray so well is the effects of trauma on generations. I guess you can call it even the Stockholm syndrome, they're calling it these days. I know that I have Jewish friends whose parents, you know, were in camps and survived, of course, obviously, and that the children seem to be suffering in many ways similar psyche disorders as if you will, or traumas as their parents. And in a way, Trudy has a little of that, doesn't she?
Definitely Trudy does, and I'm glad that you brought that up, because that's the reason Trudy's in the book. Trudy is the daughter in the novel in Those Who Save Us, and she's kind of a pill of a character, to tell you the truth. And I wrote all of her mother's story first. It took me 6 months, and then I wrote Trudy's story, and it took me 2.5 years to get right. And the reason for that is that Trudy follows her mother around in this novel saying, what did you do during the war? What did you do? Explain, 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 explain. And her mother is a trauma survivor, a Stockholm syndrome poster girl, basically, when you come to love your captor in all sorts of ways that you really shouldn't. And she has this incredibly painful past she has no intention of discussing, which maybe isn't such a bad thing. I mean, we think now, generationally, that we should confess about everything and a clean slate is always better, but that's not always the case for people who suffer incredibly deep trauma, especially confessing it to one's own child in such a loaded scenario is difficult at best. So it was really hard for me to write Trudy's part of the story. I just wanted to say, you know what, your mom's not going to talk to you about this. Snap out of it. And I almost considered axing her as a character. I have a couple of passages in my longhand notebooks in which I was weighing how would the book be different and better without Trudy, and the whole thing told from Anna's point of view. But I really needed Trudy's perspective in the novel, because I didn't want it to be quote-unquote, just a war story. I really wanted to show with the book how the atrocities of war trickle down to the next generation so that there's a first generation of innocent victims or complicit victims, and then there's a second generation who are definitely innocent victims who suffer what I think of as second-degree trauma and inherit all sorts of attitudes from their parents or in reaction to their parents' attitudes that really shapes their lives.
I can't imagine a book without Trudy. She was a brilliant character, absolutely brilliant. And you know what else? It explored something, you know, in a secondary way, which is the mother-daughter relationship under which the best of circumstances can be very intense and conflicting and, you know, also that raging storm that we talked about. Don't you agree?
Totally. In fact, I have been watching, it's been on cable recently, Terms of Endearment, which is one of my favorite books, and it's also one of my favorite movies. And, you know, the whole Aurora Greenway Emma relationship, it just makes me feel so much better to watch this because Emma says these awful things to her mom and that I find myself saying to my own mother, and Aurora Greenway is very much like my own mom. And their relationship mimics my relationship with my mom much more than the chilly relationship that my characters have in Those Who Save Us. But and I'm lucky. I mean, my mom is my best friend. I when I'm in the town I'm in now, I see her every day. We talk every day on the phone when we're not in the same place at the same time. But it is a fraught relationship for sure. And I think there's always a push-pull between the closeness that mothers and daughters can potentially feel and then the need for the child to feel independent. So you've always got this tidal pull toward and then this immense push away. And if you have vibrant, you know, vivid personalities involved, then you know, God help you.
Well, being a daughter, and, you know, I could tell you, I can relate totally. Are you Trudy? Mm-hmm. There's a lot of Trudy in
you. Oh, God,
no,
I hope not. I hope I'm not Trudy. Yeah.
No?
I really do. I mean, I sympathize with Trudy.
I love Trudy. You don't like her.
I guess I don't really so much. I mean, I admire her greatly, and I have great sympathy for her, and I empathy with her in many ways. But, and I think she's very much a creature of her circumstances and her past and her childhood, which is difficult at best. I mean, she spends her first 5 years in Nazi Germany, and then the rest of her life essentially being told that what she remembers never happened, and these scary things never happened. So she's basically, again, a sort of poster child for what early trauma can do to an adult personality. And I feel immensely sorry for her because her life has been shaped by these things that are totally beyond her control. But as a person, I mean, she was tough to write because she was tough to hang out with. She's a very angry character. And again, understandably, she's a very embittered character. And I thought, gosh, you know, I'm asking readers a lot to spend a lot of time with this woman. I really had to work her around into a position where I myself didn't mind spending time with her. But I would hope that, I mean, I've had a much easier life than Trudy. Obviously, I didn't grow up in Nazi Germany, but I would hope that I'm a little bit more ebullient in personality than she is.
I found her very interesting. And maybe
good.
Maybe, yes. Very needy, but also, you know, when she needed to, she went to find out what the story was, and I thought that was a good point of hers. When I asked you about your favorite passage the other day from Those Who Save Us, you told me that it was, "She can never tell him what she started to say, that we come to love those who save us." And as I wrote to you that day, I said, I remember when I read that line and can still conjure up the feelings I felt then. So true, so true, no matter whom it is that comes to our rescue. Let's talk about that, because I think that's just brilliant on your part to have come up with that.
Oh, thank you. Well, I think it's a lot of people's favorite line or the line that strikes them the hardest when they're reading the novel, and I think it's not really an accident because that was really the theme for the whole book. And what Anna the mother is thinking, and she's trying to explain to her new GI American husband, is we come to love those who shame us, because she is a Stockholm Syndrome survivor, and for 5 years her only adult company has been a Nazi officer who's groomed her in every way, sexually, emotionally, made her dependent on him for food, for survival, and she has come to have these feelings for him that she doesn't think that she should ever have for him, but she can't help it. And there's no way she can explain this to herself because doesn't have the psychological vocabulary or perspective to do it. And then trying to explain it to somebody else who has saved her now from the rubble of wartime Germany proves to be an impossibility. And in fact, she has to hold her tongue about it her whole life because she can never really explain to anybody her feelings for this officer who's such a deep pivotal character in her life, I would say. So that was really what I was looking at in that passage, was how we come to love those who save us and we come to love those who shame us. And for a lot of people during wartime, that's the same thing. It's the same concept. And we think of being saviors or being saved as unremittingly positive concepts, but that's not always the case. And in fact, a lot of survivors of terrible conflagrations whom you talk to have terrible burdens and you know, very heavy manacles of guilt and shame for having survived or having been saved. So that's what I was looking at in that passage.
And that is brilliant, and it so touches everybody's life. It doesn't have to be in Nazi Germany, obviously, too, because we all have traumas and all sorts of things happen through life, you know, and we learn a lot about those who save us and those who don't, whatever. But do you think that at the end of the day, don't we all save one another, in a sense?
I hope so. I mean, it would be nice. I think we, you know, save half the people and maybe the other half the people not. I mean, I thought about this a lot when I was writing the book, and people sometimes say to me, oh, do you think that Nazi Germany could happen again, or that could never happen now, or it couldn't happen in America? And I think about the choices that we make every single day. I mean, when I am in Boston, which is where my other home is, and I'm walking to my coffee shop in the morning, some mornings when I pass a homeless person, I give her a dollar. It's always the same woman, always sitting on the same corner, and some days I don't feel like it, so I don't. And in Nazi Germany, that kind of choice could have made the difference between life and death. For somebody I passed on the street, I might have an impulse to say, oh, come home with me, you look hungry, or give somebody a crust of bread that would save them and keep them from starving to death, or, you know, give them hope to get out of the country, anything. You just don't know how you affect other people's lives. And on other days, I might just walk on past. And I don't consider myself to be an especially bad, good, or unusual person. And so I think that, you know, we do the best we can, but most of us are human, and that means we're going to be fallible and mercurial, and we can only err toward helping save other people if we can.
I love your mind, darling. I love your mind. Do you hear me? I love your mind.
I hear you. I'm writing it down.
Well, I do. I mean, you know, I just love the way you think, and that's probably why I like the book. But at the end of the day, why do you think that those who saved us touched so many hearts? I mean, you know, there are a lot of books that have been written on the subject of Nazi Germany and on guilt, and yeah, you know, but this book, something different. What's your take on it?
It's a good question. I'm sure there are a lot of publishers who are trying to figure out the same thing. Like, what is the magic formula here? I think part of it is that it's a war story. It seems to me that war novels tend to do well for their authors because they have an inherent dramatic backbone. And the same thing for a lot of historical fiction that coalesces around one event, that it usually has a easier to extricate dramatic backbone than novels that might be in contemporary times. So war story is easy for people to hook into. There's a sort of universal fascination still with World War II because it is one of the rare scenarios where you see absolute good pitted against absolute evil, and you know who the good guys are, and you know who the bad guys are, and the bad guys are just so unbelievably bad. I mean, you put people in ovens and then you burn them. Like, who does this?
God.
You know? So
right.
I think there's that whole Grimm's fairy tale aspect to the time period that pulls people in and speaks to them of their childhood nightmares. I also think that because there are love stories in the novel, that always helps tug people's emotions, to put it in a sort of blunt way, I guess. But I also think it's a mother-daughter thing. And when I've gone to book clubs, and I've spoken at 1,000 book clubs in the Boston area alone, and I talk to book clubs all the time by Skype, all the time on phone. I absolutely love discussing, writing, reading my books with people. A lot of the women say to me, well, what this book was really about for me was, what would you have done in this position, this untenable position where you're asked to be the mistress to a guy who does these monstrous things? Would I do that to save my kid? Of course, you know, so I think that a lot of my readers are female, a lot of them are moms, and so a lot of them put themselves in that situation and say, okay, now I understand how somebody could be an SS officer's mistress, there's a kid involved, like, I get it, and so I think it helps explain us to ourselves a little bit.
Interesting. We're talking with Jenna Blum,
Those Who Save Us, and we're soon going to be talking to her about her latest book, The Storm Chasers. But right now we're going to take a break. Jenna, take a sip of something and have a piece of your cooking.
I'm going to turn
it to Joe, and we will be back in a few.
Fabulous.
You are listening to the Hallie Cancer Jane Show with Mojo. We are at the mid-show break. And when we come back with Jenna, we're moving on to her new book, Storm Chasers.
Social media is rapidly changing the way we discover, share, and consume information. Here at the Hallie Cancer Jane Show with Mojo, we are part of that social media revolution. If you would be interested in advertising or sponsoring The Hallie Cancer Jane Show with Mojo, email mojo at thehallieandmojoshow@gmail.com. We'll be glad to hear from you. A year in my pajamas with President Obama, The Politics of Strange Bedfellows, is written by my co-host Hallie Cancer Jane. It's on sale for a limited time for $2.99 at Amazon.com.
Today's Hallie Cancer Jane Show with Mojo is being brought to you by HCJ Studios. And now, let's get back to the Hallie Cancer Jane Show with Mojo. And if you would like to call in live to the show, you can call in to 714-202-9929 and speak with our special guest, or even Hallie Cancer Jane. Our special guest is Jenna Bloom. Now back to Hallie.
Hi there, darling. We're back, and we are talking to Jenna Blum, author of the fabulous Those Who Save Us and the equally unbelievable book, which I am loving reading. I wish I could have finished it in time to talk to you, but maybe it's better that I didn't, The Storm Chasers. But before we get to The Storm Chasers, let's talk about writing. I know a lot of people have been asking me to talk to you about that. It's interesting. How people want to understand the process of writing by good writers, which of course you are. So you spent how long? What did you tell me that you took in writing it? It was quite a long process.
It was 3 years writing Those Who Save Us and about 10 years worth of researching it. So it's definitely not the instant gratification profession. Although I would say that when I am in the writing zone or the researching zone, even it's gratifying every day. And in fact, it's almost all good. I love promotion because I get to stop playing with the imaginary people and go out and talk to the real people.
We're
going to
talk about that in a minute. Yeah.
That's really wonderful. And then the writing phase is like a form of practical magic, so that's great. And researching, which I'm about to jump into now for book three, is another kind of fantastical immersion in a different life. The only time when I'm really a bear to live with is when I feel like I should be writing and I'm not, or when I have writer's block, and then it's just like, you should just stay away from me completely. It's just,
well, now this is really interesting. That was my next question, because I've read that you've had bouts with writer's block.
I have. Somebody wrote to me once, a reader wrote to me and said, does this really exist? And I said, you bet your beep, it definitely exists, at least for me it does. And it's, writer's block for me comes when I'm asking myself the questions about a book and I'm not getting any answers. And it's unbelievably frustrating that you've sort of spun this fictional dream that in your head seems very real, and you're getting it down on paper so that other people can enter that world and come to know it the way you do, and have hopefully some really strong memories of your fictional world and some strong reactions to it. And here you are going along creating it, and all of a sudden you fall into like a plot hole, and there's just doesn't seem to be any way out of it. So you're basically down in this hole thrashing around until a solution to this plot problem or character problem presents itself, and then you can go on. As a perfectionist, and as my first editor said, a neurotic, I find it really hard not to have all my ducks in a row when I'm writing. And even though I start out with an outline and I have it up on my wall literally, and a sort of map of what the book is, and it shifts 11 times during the writing of the book, there are always these question marks too in the middle of my outlines where I don't know exactly what's going to happen, and it has to be something that both moves the book forward and is totally organic to the characters. So often that's where my writer's block comes in, is that nexus, like how do you keep the book moving and yet have it be faithful to the character's predicament and not just be something that you, the writer, graft onto it. That's really hard, and that makes me really cranky.
I can imagine. You've said that a writer's life is like crop rotation. So Jenna the loner versus Jenna the, what, adventurer versus the multifaceted, rugged individual. I mean, you know, we're about to get to the other side of Jenna Blum, but it's interesting to me. Crop rotation.
That's, I guess it's what I was describing before, is that, you know, there's promotional mode, and there's writing mode, and there's research mode, and then there's, excuse me, bitch mode, because I'm, you know, having a block. But it really, for me, I can't do any of those things at the same time. And I know a lot of writers who can. My good friend Randy Susan Myers, who's also a former student of mine at Grub Street, is, you know, working on polishing her second book. She's promoting her first book. She's, you know, just sold her third book. And I just stand there in awe and marvel at her, because I can't possibly imagine having all those crops growing at the same time. For me, it's about writing or promoting or researching. Like, that's, they're very different feelings. But if it helps any, my mom calls me Jenna the Farmer, because and she started calling me that this summer, because I have this house in rural Minnesota, and I planted a garden for the first time, and I spent a lot of obsessive time out in the garden, like growing way too much kale and tomatoes and, you know, whatever. But I think that farming metaphors come naturally to me, because my mom's side of the family, we're all farmers, and so I loved growing this garden, and that's probably why I refer to writing in the same sort of terms. That, you know,
it,
really,
it made a lot of sense to me, but I'm like you, I've got that farmer side, so I can relate to that.
Yeah, I like the farmer side. It's fun. I like being a farmer.
Exactly. You think writing is a disease, an addictive disease, a virus?
No,
it's interesting why some people are so, that's all they can do. I mean, that's it. They've got to write. Even if
they're not
professional
writers. I
don't
really have it to that degree. You know, I really don't. I know there are a lot of writers who are like that, but again, I have this sort of crop rotation thing going on. There are long fallow periods in my life where I think my fields are, my emotional fields, my mental fields are sort of fallow, despite my wanting to write all the time, because they have to be, because they have to sort of prepare themselves for the next crop. And unlike me, there are many writers I know who write all the time. They have to write a certain amount every day. And we would have these protracted arguments in grad school as to whether I really was a writer if I didn't write every day. Like, I write, therefore I am. I write, therefore I am a writer. But I kind of think that's bull. I mean, I think that there are as many different ways to write as there are individuals who write. And the important thing is that you believe in your stories and you love your stories and you get them down on paper so other people can read them. Then, boom, you're a writer.
You are interesting to me as a writer also, because I think that you're a business person too. I mean, I watch you day in and day out. I don't know anybody who promotes as well as you do. Writing is a business, right? You have to tell people that it's not just the writing. It is also the selling, right?
It is now. I mean, if I am a business person, it's quite inadvertent. I'm a terrible money person, and I don't feel as though I have a great head for that, which is why I have an accountant who specializes in writers. But I do feel that nobody is going to love your books as much as you do. I mean, your agent, almost. Your mom, almost. Your best friend, maybe. But nobody's going to believe in your books the way you do. And if you write them, why not get out there and hustle for them? So when I'm promoting my books, which I do on Facebook and on Twitter, or I should say I'm promoting the events at which I speak about my books, what I'm trying to do is strike a balance somewhere between being obnoxious and being like, oh my God, look, there's another thing about my book today. Isn't that fabulous? And also just letting people know where I'm going to be, so if they have questions or comments, they can come and find me live and talk to me about them. And I think that's a joy. So, but yeah, really, I'm kind of a stage mother who's trying not to be as obnoxious as most stage mothers. Like, my books are my kids. I got to get them out there.
Right. And you do it quite well. And I like the way that you handle yourself. I watch you, you know, with the social media. I mean, you called yourself a social media hoe. I think
that's the
welcome to the world today. Writing a blockbuster hit novel on your debut novel like that, getting all that fame and whatever fortune and you know, it's just such a stellar. Okay, now you got to write another book. That's got to be a nightmare. How do you follow it up?
Yeah, that was fun. Well, I was grateful to have the chance to do it, for one thing, because I did spend so much of my life trying desperately to be a published writer. I published a lot of short stories in high school and in college, and when I was working as a waitress for a decade after college, you know, just publishing short stories in literary magazines who paid in contributors' copies. And I still consider this to be amazing triumphs, because it was really, really hard to do. To get a short story published in a magazine is still an incredibly hard thing to do. when the first book came out, when Those Who Save Us came out, I felt as though finally I was a card-carrying writer. I mean, I literally then could get my Writer's Guild card. My dad had a Writer's Guild card. Now I had a Writer's Guild card. So it enabled me to stop waking up in the middle of the night thinking, when is this going to happen? When is this going to happen? I mean, I slept a little bit better. But you never really stop worrying about your stuff and what you can do and doing your best by your fictional people to get them out in the world. And soon it came time for me to write another book. And because Those Who Save Us, thanks to the book clubs, was so miraculously successful, The Storm Chasers, my second book, was sold before it was written. It was sold on what is in the industry called a partial, which is, you know, like a chapter and an outline. And it was sold at auction to Dutton. And that's a really rare thing. And, of course, what happened immediately after that, even though I loved the book, I had carried it around in my head for 10 years, I'd done all my due diligence, I'd been out storm chasing, I'd researched bipolar disorder, which is what the book is about, I immediately froze. And felt as though everything I had to write had to be perfect because I was writing under contract on a deadline. And, of course, any writer knows that nothing you write is ever perfect right out of the starting gate, or rarely it is. And so the way I was thinking I had to write it was antithetical to the act of writing. And so I kind of sat around on my butt for a while agonizing and going to IKEA a lot and H&M and Borders and finally not writing at all.
So let's talk about The Storm Chasers. What I love this book. I'm really enjoying this book too.
Thank you. In some ways,
it's very similar. You know, not similar. You know, it deals with secrets also, but it's just such a different book, and it's just what wonderful characters. And I tell you, the storm chasing scenes are to die for. I mean, I just told Joe before the show, I'm going with her. I'm a bit of an adventure crazy person myself, but
yeah,
I would love
come
to
along.
Do that. Give us a little, you know, we're at the 46 mark, but let's at least get a little background on what the story is before we get into it a little bit, so the listeners know if they haven't read it.
Absolutely, yeah, thank you. And I'm glad you said the books are similar, because I'm always surprised when people talk about how dissimilar they are. To me, they're the same. The books have the same DNA, even though they have very different faces, because they're both about people whose lives get drastically rearranged by enormous forces beyond their control. And in Those Who Save Us, it's Nazi Germany and the Nazi juggernaut. In Storm Chasers, what I'm looking at is mental instability, mental illness, because the novel is about a pair of boy-girl twins, Charles and Karina Hollingdahl. And Charles is bipolar, and his sister Karina isn't, his twin sister isn't. And the book is essentially about Charles's disorder and its ripple effects and how it affects Karina's life and their family's life and the lives of everybody they know and love, and the twins' very different reactions to how Charles should manage his disorder. And so really, what I hope with The Storm Chasers is that it functions as a sort of lightning rod for people who may be bipolar or are dealing with bipolar disorder, caring for a loved one who has it, trying to cope with it in some form or another, because often this harkens back to Those Who Save Us, too. People who have bipolar in their families keep it a big secret, and then it sort of exacerbates the dysfunction that the disorder itself causes. So I am really hoping that readers who are dealing with this issue will be able to talk about it because of the book, and I've been really gratified to get fantastic reader response from people who are not bipolar, or, you know, are just interested in the topic or have become interested through reading the novel.
Well, it's equally as haunting, I'll tell you that, because you know there's a secret there. You know you know what, in a way, what's going to happen, but yet you don't know what's going to happen. You understand the volatility of that. And I love the fact that you put the volatility of, you know, bipolar disorder against, you know, bipolar nature, Mother Nature.
Right.
I mean, I just thought that
right.
that was just brilliant on your part. I'm going to bring Joe in. Joey, because Joe is – loves the concept of storm chasing and meteorology. You have a question for Jenna? Are you
Jenna,
with us, Joe?
Back.
Hey.
Yes. let me give you a very short story of a very long story. When I was about 5 years old, living in Louisville, Kentucky, we had a storm coming up. And, of course, you know, at 5 years old, you don't really have the concept or comprehension of what's getting ready to happen. But when the wind picked me up and flew me into the arms of my father, and we proceeded to the basement, I knew something was seriously wrong, and I wasn't in trouble. That started the spark for me to go out and do a little storm chasing here and there. Nothing on a grand scheme like you have done. But tell me, what goes through your blood when you see those storms, just that immense energy that's out there? What goes through your blood?
Just awe, which in its purest form is a combination of wonder and dread. And, you know, that's the immensity of the storms and their magnificence, because they actually have shapes. They look like giant flying saucer motherships and big sky sculptures, and they're all different colors. They can be dark purple or black or brownish gray. It depends on, you know, what's going on with the storm. But each one of them has a sort of personality, and each one of them is so immense and reinforces how tiny people are in comparison to nature, and how wicked it can be, and then how calm and serene and beautiful afterwards. But it never fails to awe me, and it never fails to teach me something. And I'm an aspiring sort of pseudo-meteorologist myself, and so I have picked this up as a childhood fascination, as you have, and then continued it into my adult life, and now I'm sort of an acolyte, and I really want to keep learning about the mechanics and the majesty of big weather.
And that's definitely one of the sidelines and hobbies.
What did you say, Joe?
What's that?
And that's definitely one of my sidelines and hobbies. One of my friends is a meteorologist out here in Salt Lake. Actually, I've got a lot of friends who are meteorologists, but it's wonderful. Go ahead, Hallie.
I live in, you know, in Mother Nature, and I think that what I would say is that the attraction is the art of it. It's like looking at a painting, you know, and it changes every single second, more than anything else in life. And I think that's an addiction to look at, to follow, to play. And I'll tell you, with this book, it's interesting to me because you are a storm chaser. You write about storm chasing, and I think that proves a very interesting thing that I tell a lot of my young people who are asking me about writing, which is you've got to be an interesting person to write interesting characters. So you go,
or
girl.
Or a really dull person who spends a lot of time in a chair and every once in a while ventures out and does crazy things that you're fascinated with. I think, you know, that's what writing is for me. It's been a very lucky profession, because all the things that I'm obsessed with, I then get to go and research, and it's part of my job to go out and do these things. And I really love it. I was thinking about, you know, my research for book 3, which unfortunately I can't talk about because I can't give the book away, and I'm very, very superstitious about it. But I will tell you that when I was making a list on my iPhone today of things I needed to research, one of the items was learn to ride a horse. So, you know, this is the kind of stuff I do when I go out to research a book. I go storm chasing, or I go to Germany with my mom, or I, you know, ride horses, or, you know, whatever I think is going to help make the experience of the reading more real for my readers. I feel very great.
You're speaking to a horsewoman. Go ride, darling.
Oh, good. Well, you know what? I
love it.
I was like, who's going to teach me to ride a horse? Maybe you.
Oh, there's
but
nothing,
I'm
there's nothing like it.
The,
yeah, I'm telling you, this one you're going to like a lot.
So, I hope so, because if I fall off the horse, then I know who I'm going to
come find. No big deal. Just get up and get on it again.
Yeah, so they say. All right. It's probably a little safer for me to be chasing a storm because I'm in a vehicle. You know, I know how to drive, so that's a good thing. I think that
having grown up
in New Jersey and, you know, living in Boston taught me a lot about driving during severe weather. I mean, comparatively speaking, driving on the East Coast is a lot tougher.
Oh,
but,
that's for sure. I totally agree. Your favorite line from Storm Chaser: sometimes when you throw yourself on the world, it will hold you up. The sometimes is where I got caught.
Good. Well, I think for my characters, this is from my character Karina, who's the one who's always trying to take care of her twin brother Charles and watch out for Charles and to keep him safe. And we talked about the theme of saving with those who save us, and you said, don't we all try and save people? And I think the tragedy for a lot of us, and certainly for my characters, is that they try to save people whom it's not really their, I was going to say it's not their job to save, but it's not within their capability to save. And yet they go on gamely trying anyway. And Karina is trying to put her arms around a problem that is far beyond her to solve, which is to control Charles's moods and to control his instability. And she's really not capable of doing that, because nobody is except Charles. And yet she loves him so desperately, and she really wants to try and keep him safe. And that's the crux of the novel. Again, it's how far do you go to protect somebody you love? How far do you go to try and save that person? And Karina, as a result of having lived with somebody she loves more than anybody in the world whose moods are totally changeable and can often be extremely dangerous, has grown up thinking and experiencing that the world is a very unsafe place and is suspicious of everything and everybody. And she becomes, probably not surprisingly, a reporter whose job it is to, you know, ferret out everybody's secrets and look for the dangerous spots in people. So she's always, always, always prepared. And so part of her emotional journey in the novel is to find out that sometimes the world does hold you up. And so the sometimes for her is a glass half full concept, as opposed to the way you might be reading it as in, you know, it might be a glass half empty. But for her, it's kind of a blessing to figure that out.
Great theme, another great theme, another great book. Who are you reading these days? Who do you like?
Oh, my gosh, my brain just totally shorted out when you asked me that, as it always does. I mean, I read mostly galleys right now. I'm in the privileged position of having other writers send me their books and also publishers send me their books, so I get great sneak previews of books that are coming out, like, next spring or next year. And so I don't read a lot of fiction that is on the shelves right this very second, although I do listen to it in my car, so, you know, that's kind of fun. I just read a galley, or I'm about to embark upon a galley by Laura Moriarty, who teaches at the University of Kansas and has written a couple of books I really love. So it's fun to get a sneak preview from a writer whose works you admire. I read a book by Kate Alcott that's coming out next spring called The Dressmaker, about what happened to the people who survived the Titanic and had to make some really tough moral choices. So that was fun. Rebecca Rasmussen, who is a debut novelist whose work I just love. I read her book, The Bird Sisters, this year. One of my students, Anna Solomon, The Little Bride, that just came out this year. So I read that in galley form, too. And so I really am, I guess, engaged with a whole crop of new writers, and I get to have the previews from already established writers who are churning out new stuff. That's pretty much what I'm
reading. Do you have a favorite all-time writer?
No, I don't. It really depends on my mood. I love Larry McMurtry, Terms of Endearment, Lonesome Dove. I love Gone with the Wind. I love Stephen King's early work, because I think the man really knows how to tell a story. And I love all the Anns, like Ann Patchett and Ann Tyler. And I aspire to be William Styron, who himself aspired to write books that were about moral conundrum, but then to wrap that in beautiful writing. And that's what he wanted to do, and I would like to be him, except not dead. So there you go.
Probably a good thought there, that second half of that thing. Oh, my gosh.
Throw that out there.
Yeah. Yeah, well, I love it. I would then say, is it fair to say that is Diary of Anne Frank changed your life, huh?
I thought a lot of books changed my life. The Wizard of Oz changed my life. Obviously, the Storm Chasers, the storm chasing theme, like Joe, I was obsessed with severe weather from an early age, and it was because coming to visit my grandma in the southeast Minnesota town, I was exposed to seeing a tornado at night when I was 4, and I was never quite the same afterwards. And it's because of The Wizard of Oz. I thought I was in the book. So that changed my life. The Little House books changed my life. Harriet the Spy changed my life. The Diary of Anne Frank. My children's books tend to grow into adult fascinations. So there's really nothing more valuable a writer can do at any age than read. And I'll put in a little plug here, like, read real books. Like, go buy real books in bookstores.
Go buy real books.
Buy real books.
Well, those books changed your life. You changed my life with Those Who Save Us.
Oh, thank you.
Fabulous book. Fabulous. If you haven't read it, everybody, please read it. It is a book that everybody should read. Equally, just engaging, The Storm Chasers. Jenna Blum, author, Those Who Saved Us, The Storm Chasers. You can follow her at jenna.blum on Facebook. She's on Twitter. You can visit her at jennablum.com. And Jenna, thank you so much for stopping by and sharing so much of yourself with the Hallie Kasser Jane Show with Mojo. I can't tell you, this has been fabulous for me, and I hope it has for everybody who's listening. You're not going to tell us about your new book yet, so you'll have to come back and tell us about it when it comes out.
I always love to, and I'm like,
and I hope it's not 15 years from now.
I'm on the phone, so no, Definitely not. My agent would not spin for it. So I'm curtsying too, but you can't see it because I'm on the phone. So that's unfortunate. But I really appreciate you having me on the show and asking me such great questions. It's been a total pleasure.
Well, it's been a pleasure for us too. We'll talk to you soon. Thanks a lot, Jenna.
That was great. Thanks, Holly.
Okay.
Take care. Thanks, Joe.
You're welcome, Jenna. We'll talk to you soon.
Keep chasing storms.
Oh, yes, I will.
And making them.
Yes, sir.
Okay, Joe, it's all yours.
Well, guess what? You've been listening to the Hallie Kasser Jane Show with our special guest today, Jenna Blum. She's up in Minnesota, but she also works in Boston, Massachusetts. And great show, Hallie. And who do we got for next week?
Next week, who do we have for next week? We have Barry Rubin. Oh, my gosh. After talking about those who save us, Barry is the go-to guy on the Middle East, writes about Israel, Palestinian conflict. He is absolutely a genius, and he has some very interesting points of view. So let everybody know who's interested in what's going on in the Middle East, and particularly with the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, that Barry Rubin, who doesn't always do this kind of thing, is coming on the show next Sunday. That's October 23rd.
And that would be at 5 p.m. Eastern, 2 p.m. Pacific, or 2100 hours. I'm going to say gross mean time, but Greenwich mean time. So until then, we want you to have a wonderful week. And make sure you check out the postings on Facebook from Hallie Kasser Jane and the Hallie Kasser Jane Show with Mojo. If you got anything that you want to tell us about, suggestions, comments, gripes, whatever, don't forget our email is thehallieandmojoshow@gmail.com. And what can I say? I hope everyone has a wonderful, wonderful week. And if you are out chasing storms, make sure you are protected. This is Mojo for the Hallie Kasser Jane Show. See you next Sunday.